I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times.
Until we know for certain what caused this tragedy, I just want to reiterate what I have already said, that we are a growing country with a growing economy. We need to invest in the infrastructure that keeps us that way, and not just when something bad happens, like a bridge collapse or a train derailment, but all the time. That's what great nations do.
That was President Obama speaking after the tragic train derailment in Philadelphia 2 weeks ago. Although the cause of the accident has not been determined yet, it's believed that positive train control could have prevented it. This is just one piece of railway infrastructure that's in need of an upgrade. The Highway Trust Fund that's supposed to pay for road improvements from a gas tax doesn't come close to covering those costs. It's up for a vote in Congress at the end of the month. The country's overall infrastructure is in critical need of repair or replacement. According to the World Economic Forum, the U.S. ranks 16th in the state of its infrastructure compared to the rest of the world. We asked Robert Puentes to join us on Radio Times. He's a senior fellow with the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program. He directs the program's Metropolitan Infrastructure Initiative. And Robert Puentes, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Do you think this positive train control technology could have prevented the derailment in Philadelphia?
Well, I think it could have, or at least could have mitigated the damage. It's proven technology, and the National Transportation Safety Board has found that it could have prevented at least 25 crashes over the last last decade. So we know that it works. We know that it actually could have had some kind of impact, some kind of positive impact in this corridor. But getting all this deployed, finding the resources to do it, closing down tracks so you can put it all in, all of these things take time. It's disruptive. But I think we're going to see some action, hopefully, now that we've had this tragedy.
I mean, as you say, it's complicated to install this technology. But is that a good enough excuse?
No. I think that it's one excuse. It's not certainly not good enough. Anytime that there's a tragedy like this, when lives are lost, there is no good excuse. There's no doubt about it. But I think that when these things happen, it does tend to highlight then these problems. It, unfortunately, as you talked about at the beginning or as was talked about in the comments, it does seem to take some kind of a bridge collapse or a water main to break or flooding in Texas. I mean, we start to then pay attention to these things a little bit more. We don't really get all of the action I think we need, but it amplifies the issue. It puts it on people's radar because infrastructure, as important as it is to the economy, as important as it is to the environment, as important as it is to people, it only is something that we pay attention to when disaster strikes. And we've got to change. We've got to change.
You have said even beyond what the tragedy of that happened in Philadelphia, that when you look at the train system that we have, there are electrical systems that need an upgrade. There are old tunnels that are being used. I think anyone that goes up and down between Washington and Boston can attest to that fact. What other infrastructure needs when it comes to Amtrak?
Well, I think the Northeast Corridor is the place where there really needs to be much greater investment, much greater attention, particularly to these pinch points. There's a tunnel in and around Baltimore that's in real serious need of a major upgrade. There's a bridge project over the Hackensack River up in New Jersey, which is a pinch point where trains have to slow down because the bridge sometimes doesn't close. But it's either way, it's where a lot of these trains come together. We've got to stop thinking about it as a big national system and really think about it as three systems, as the Northeast Corridor, which is by far the most heavily traveled, particularly between Washington and New York, but also up into Boston. Then there are these long-distance routes that literally traverse the entire continental United States, which provide a lifeline to some rural communities, but it's where we have to invest a lot of public money because they don't cover its costs. And then we have these shorter distance routes where the states are starting to take on a larger role in their operating subsidies for them, places like in Virginia and in Maine and in Illinois, a bunch of these. There's about 13 of these around the country that are also starting to be much more part of the larger transportation system as opposed to some kind of federal intrusion. So we've got to think about it as three different systems and then make particular investments in those pinch points where the delays happen.
Is the Northeast Corridor profitable?
Profitable is a tough word to use in the context of Amtrak. But the Northeast Corridor does generate a positive operating balance insofar as it costs less to run the service than the revenues it brings in through passenger fares and other things. But there's all kinds of legacy costs. There's capital costs. There's depreciation, things like that. But, yes, it throws off more revenue than it costs to operate the system, unlike those long-distance routes.
Well, as you know, Amtrak has its critics, and I thought it was interesting. A day or two after the derailment, the House Republicans voted to cut something like $260 million from Amtrak's budget. What's your response to that? I mean, what's the message there?
The optics were terrible. I think that they probably should have delayed that vote, at least for more than a day. It really didn't seem like there was much sensitivity to the tragedy that had happened. So that's kind of the way Washington is running these days. That said, I think that we're starting to figure out what then the federal role is in Amtrak and how to shift it from this system, which was invented in the 1970s from the carcass of the passenger the private passenger railroads who didn't want to run passenger service anymore, but the federal government decided, well, it's important enough that we continue this, and they created Amtrak. It was kind of designed to fail in a lot of ways. I don't think anybody ever thought it was going to be, quote-unquote, profitable, but it's limped along from year after year after year because people recognize that in places like the Northeast Corridor, it actually is super competitive and very efficient. In places like California and in and around Chicago also has good service. And then has a public policy benefit in some of these rural areas that may not have air service or may need these kind of connections into major metropolitan areas. So we're starting to get to think about it, though, as a fundamental part of the overall transportation network, and not just this weird thing that was created 40 years ago, and is probably it's hard to overestimate how unique Amtrak is from a governance structure. And how it operates throughout the country.
One thing you have said, and this is perhaps about our overall infrastructure, that it's a mistake to overstate the role of the federal government. As it turns out, states and local governments are playing a much larger role than they used to.
Yeah, and you give Congress some credit for that. I mean, they are the ones who decided a few years ago that these short-distance routes, they're about 750 miles or less, excluding the Northeast Corridor, but the ones that are 750 miles or less, that if the states wanted this service, that they were going to have to contribute to its operating costs. They were going to have to contribute some of their own money. And that was the right move because I think in almost every case we've seen that, like in places like Virginia, when the states have skin in the game, when they're contributing to this, and it's not just some weird thing coming out of Washington, that it becomes a much better, much more integrated in the overall state transportation network, and they can think about it in the context of the roadway system and the transit system, aviation, freight rail, all of these things when the states have skin in the game. And those short-distance routes are starting to be where we're seeing healthy ridership and we're seeing generally equal operating costs to revenues.
Do you think there's room and even money for a high-speed train? I don't know if that would work along the Northeast Corridor because it's so crowded. I mean, anyone that goes to Europe or if you go to Japan, you've got new trains. They're fast trains. They come on time. Is it possible to take what is happening in other countries and apply it to the United States?
It's certainly possible. It's going to be really expensive, particularly in the Northeast Corridor,
right,
for the reasons you mentioned. I mean, look, it's got to be straight. It's got to be flat. And anybody who's taken the train in the Northeast Corridor knows that it's curvy and it's old.
It's none of those
things,
has,
yeah. Yeah, and you've got buildings in the way. You've got land that you've got to buy. So it's going to be tough. But there are three different high-speed rail proposals that are underway right now in this country. There's the one in California that's gotten a lot of attention, that's gone to the voters. The voters have approved it. They're committed to getting that thing built. There's a private proposal between Dallas and Houston. Again, very straight, very flat, very direct between those two major metropolitan areas. A lot of that's backed by Japanese technology is going to come in there. And then there's a proposal in Florida, also a private venture between Orlando and Miami. So I think all of those things have real potential to get done. And once we could see this get done and folks can understand, here's what we're talking about. This the model is like what's happened in other places. Other than China, which just kind of builds it, you know, all at once, other countries, they build starter lines and they get that thing to work. And then people get it and they like it and they're going to build another one. And you kind of iterate on it. And I think that's what's going to happen here in this country once these things get up and running.
It sounds like there's a role for the private sector. Is that the government, whether it's local, state, or federal, can't do this all by itself?
Right. And I think this is what we're starting to see is this transition into new partnerships and not privatization in the negative term that we're selling off, you know, public assets or the private companies are getting fat on people's, passenger fares and things like this. But true partnerships where we're problem solving with the public sector, the federal government, states and the cities, And then the private sector, you've got philanthropy involved in some cases. They're helping to contribute to the construction of a rail line in the city of Detroit, for example. So they're going to – it's a big country, right? Mm-hmm. And so things are going to look different from place to place. But this bottoms-up problem-solving between public, private, civic, philanthropic sectors – I think is how we're going to get a lot of infrastructure done in this country because the leadership is not coming out of Washington these days.
But what I hear you saying is that there is some improvement when it comes to infrastructure. I remember interviewing Ed Rendell when he was governor of Pennsylvania a number of years ago, and he and then Governor Schwarzenegger and Mayor Bloomberg, mm-hmm. this was about a decade ago, were sounding the alarm about infrastructure and saying, come on, folks, we got to address this issue. Are you saying that in spite of what Congress may or may not be doing, that the country is beginning to do this?
In a different way than probably Governor Rendell would want. I think he has been a wonderful spokesperson on all of this and clearly gets this, is very passionate about it, and is a very compelling speaker on all this stuff. I think that, though, that waiting for Washington to come to the rescue is going to be tough right now. We just haven't seen – look, there should be a major federal investment. The federal government really should care about the built environment and the nation's infrastructure. But this is as broken as a lot of folks have ever seen it. And so because Americans are problem solvers, because we're not waiting around for the cavalry to come, cities and metropolitan areas and the private sector are stepping up and starting to take on some of those roles and responsibilities. You've got states all with their own gasoline taxes that are starting to raise their own, red states like Wyoming, blue states like Maryland, as opposed to what's happening here in Washington, where the federal government has not raised the gas tax in over 20 years. You've got private sector entities coming in with these new kinds of partnerships, picking up some of the risks and some of the rewards for getting some of these things done, where we're not seeing the federal government do that. Projects that have federal money take years and years and years, 10, 12, 13 years. And so people are even foregoing federal money even when it's there because it takes so darn long to get these projects done. So, it's a big country. Infrastructure is a huge area. It's different when you talk about ports and pipes and roads and rails. I mean, all these things are so different. But it's this new kind of problem solving, it's this transition that's going on now that I think is going to have positive returns at the end of the day.
And we're almost up on a break here. Are we still recovering from the Great Recession, as we call it, in terms of at least thinking about additional money to go into infrastructure?
For sure. Interest rates are at historic low rates. It's very cheap for states and cities to borrow money right now, but we're not seeing them do that. I think a lot of that is because, as you mentioned, it's still this hangover from the recession. They're still very debt averse, so they're just not taking advantage of it as they should. But the federal government did have a big role to play in that. Infrastructure, other than the tax cuts, was the biggest share of the recovery package. And so I think it wasn't as enough as a lot of folks like Governor Rendell probably would want and probably had the right to expect. But we do know that went to projects that we needed to do. It was the basic maintenance, upkeep, this quote-unquote shovel-ready projects that had to get done because we're trying to put Americans back to work.
Well, we are talking about the country's infrastructure needs with Robert Puentes from the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program. We'll take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Robert Puentes about the country's roads and bridges, tunnels, railroad tracks, pipelines. That's our infrastructure. And we're taking comments at Radio Times at WHYY.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be taking some calls in just a moment or two. Let me go back. I do want to move on to some other parts of our infrastructure, Robert. But I do want to just ask one more question about the Northeast Corridor. I was reading from the American Society of Civil Engineers that there's something like $1 billion in capital needs along the Northeast Corridor. Mm-hmm. Is that right? $1 billion?
Yeah, depends on how you – I mean, there are things that we want to do and things that we need to do. But they were talking about numbers like that for sure.
And I mean, if where do you find $1 billion? Obviously, that – not you personally, but this requires obviously prioritizing. Yes?
Exactly. And I think that – look, $1 billion goes really fast, too. I mean, that portal bridge over the Hackensack River in New Jersey, which has to be fixed, that alone is $1 billion. The Baltimore tunnel, which has to be fixed, is $1.5 billion. So it's two projects just right there that are both considered to be priority projects, not even getting into all the other things we already talked about around positive train control and straightening out some curves and, you know, doing just the basic maintenance that we have to do. So a billion sounds like a lot. It goes really, really fast in a place like the Northeast Corridor.
So, I mean, taking the Hackensack Bridge, I mean, do you put that on the top of the list, or does it share the top of the list with other bridges that are in such shape?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't. It's easy for me to say. I'm not behind the scenes operating, but I think, look, anything related to the safety of the system has to be number one priority. I think kind of expediting then positive train control, doing whatever it has to, what you have to do. We're talking about having the cameras that are going to be in the calves of the trains now. Safety has to be number one priority. But I think close behind it are these areas of the pinch points where things start to slow down, and where we can't run an efficient system because it's just built for literally for a different generation of travel. Mm. I mean, again, these things are so old. They've just reached the end of their useful life. They're not engineered to last forever. And because in this country, I mean, a lot of these things that were built in the 40s and 50s and 60s, you just have to be rebuilt and reinvested in. They're just not we have to just continue to rehabilitate them because they don't last forever. And we don't get that really, I think, as Americans in this country.
Well, I mean, obviously that requires spending money. And one way that the government spends money is that they raise taxes or they cut programs or they, you know, find money one way or the other. I mean, there's no getting around that, is there?
No. I mean, again, I think part of it is prioritization. So Amtrak is a great example where it's this big national system. But if we're going to prioritize, obviously the Northeast Corridor, I think, deserves some particular attention. And the bill that passed the House back in March will start to do this. Will actually require some of the revenues generated, the positive revenues generated in the Northeast Corridor, to be reinvested back in the corridor rather than going to support the system, you know, all throughout the country. And this is tough, and we're gonna. It's not how we built the system before. The interstate highway system was funded through this federal gasoline tax, and that went all across the country. And they had to convince folks in New Jersey that it mattered that we build an interstate in Montana. And we've kind of gotten away from that in this country.
Well, even the Highway Trust Fund, which is interesting, this is the 18.4 cents per gallon tax on gasoline, hasn't been raised in more than 20 years since 1993. And it brings in, as I'm reading here, about $34 billion a year, but again, not enough to cover the cost, I guess, of repairing or replacing our roads and our highway system. Is this an argument for raising the gas tax? And, of course, people are getting much better mileage on their cars than they did back in the 1990s.
Yes, I think we do have to raise the federal gasoline tax just for the reasons that we mentioned. Again, just the basic maintenance upkeep of the system is going to require that source be raised. We're talking about other things because, as you mentioned, we know that it's not a sustainable source in the future. Not only are we driving more fuel-efficient cars, we're actually driving less. We're seeing historic drops in driving, even though it might be ticking up because we're a growing country. Per capita driving is declining and continues to. So we're not driving as much. When we are driving, we're driving more fuel-efficient cars. That's throwing off less revenue in the gasoline from the gasoline tax at the time that we need to have these reinvestments back into the system. So it's a vicious cycle. The gas tax got to be the workhorse in the short term, but we've got to start looking for other sources into the future. We've talked about charges that are where your vehicles are tracked by satellite and you pay for the roads that you use when you use them. If you use a road in a congested part of the day, you'd probably pay more than someone who uses a not congested road at different parts of the day. There's lots of different ideas that we have out there. We've got to get moving on something.
But is it our political system that's holding us back?
I think so. I mean, it's easy to point to Washington again because it is as broken as a lot of folks have seen it, particularly in Congress. But again, I think that Washington's not going to lead in this, but they will react. And the innovation we see happening is coming out of cities and states and metropolitan areas around the country. So this idea for this vehicle charge that I mentioned, Oregon is piloting that. They've already got that up and running. We can learn from that example and scale that throughout the country. Gas taxes, as I said, are being raised in states like Wyoming and Maryland and across the country. A lot of places in the Intermountain West are going to their voters in having them approve sales tax increases and things like that to pay for capital projects. You've got fares going up in transit. So a lot of things are happening outside of the Beltway in America that are not reflective of the conversation happening in Washington.
We're seeing more toll roads, are we?
Yes, we're seeing some more toll roads, but I think that even that model's been looked at because, as we mentioned, as Americans are driving less, you know, the calculation that would go into well, you know, can the toll road then throw off enough revenue to pay for it? The calculation is not the same as it was, particularly the interest from the private sector, which was, I think, very strong a few years ago, recognizing that toll revenues are a nice, sustainable source of revenue over a long period. Because of these historic shifts in driving, I think they're rethinking those calculations as well.
And that's Robert Puentes joining us today on Radio Times, talking about making investments in our infrastructures, some of the most basic parts of the country, whether it's the roads, the highways, the bridges, the tunnels. He's a senior fellow with the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program. And you can send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. I'm kind of a nerd for infrastructure topics.
That's great.
Everyone's nodding at me. Yes, you are. And apparently Robert Puentes is as well. So we want to hear from our fellow nerds in the audience that care about these things like infrastructure. Robert, I have to say, a couple of people put some comments on our Facebook page that your last name translates into bridges and you're interested in infrastructure. So I guess it was fated that you would, this would be your
total coincidence.
Exactly. Let me get David from Central New Jersey to join us on Radio Times. Hi, David. Go ahead. Thanks. You're on the air.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome.
For taking my call.
Sure.
My father-in-law was an Ivy League educated, nationally recognized city planner recruited by Robert Moses. So in that context, I'll tell you his comment when he offered his services free when he retired in my New Jersey suburb. Officials wouldn't listen to him on one intersection. And when a car full of kids died in an intersection on a prom night, they took his free recommendations. But he said, at least where I live in central New Jersey, that is the system. People die, you get change.
Well, and I wonder to you, Robert Puentes, I mean, is that sort of how we do things in this country when it comes to infrastructure? Are we thinking of bridges that fall down, things like that?
Unfortunately, I think when those things happen, there are reactions that way. I think that does happen. But I think what's the caller is talking about, there is a shift that's happening, I think, on the local level where we're starting to move away from a transportation system, the roadway system, which is just has focused on just moving people and moving vehicles very fast through intersections from one place to another, and starting to shift that a little bit. So it's less about just moving things rapidly and focusing on velocity and level of service and these arcane terms that don't really have a place, I think, in 21st century local areas like in central New Jersey, and focusing more on accessibility and what can you actually get to through a particular transportation improvement? What kind of jobs can you get to? What kind of economic opportunity is stimulated from these investments? And when you start to change the purpose of the investments, you start to get to things like better safety and just not focused on these high-speed kind of corridors where we do see a lot of these tragedies, unfortunately, happen.
Yeah, David, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Actually, an email from Pam. She says, I've heard from various pundits that the Northeast Corridor will never be adequately funded because the train travels through reliably blue states. Can this be true? Isn't what's good for Boston, Philadelphia, Wilmington, Baltimore, Washington, D.C. good for America? And, of course, it's helped, I guess, that the vice president of the United States lives in Wilmington, Delaware. But nonetheless, what's your response to Pam?
I think that's right. I mean, again, because we don't really think about it as a big national system, it's even worse, I think, than Pam said. So we have these big challenges with air travel, for example, and so much of the congestion for the national system is actually born out of the Philly-New York corridor. The airspace around there is so congested, it backs up the rest of the country. So there's an aviation and there's an air kind of solution to that. We never then make the next step, which is then, well, what flights can we take off the system and actually put them on rails? We have a very effective and competitive Northeast Corridor. More people take the train between D.C. and New York than fly. If we can do more of that, if we actually think about it as a system of air, roads, rails, I mean everything else, then you can start to you can do better problem solving. But we're one of the only industrialized countries on the planet that thinks about these things separately, a separate aviation system, a separate railway system, a separate highway system. It's crazy. Hmm. And so I think that to her point, I think if you start to think about it that way, that congestion, air congestion in the Northeast Corridor that affects other parts of the country might have a rail solution in the Northeast Corridor But it's hard for people to get their minds around that.
Let me ask you about something else, and this always comes up when talking about infrastructure and things like structurally deficient bridges. And when you see the phrase structurally deficient, it makes you feel like, oh my gosh, this bridge is going to fall down.
Yeah.
But clearly it's not. I mean, we're allowed to use these bridges. I'm not sure how we're supposed to cross them, you know, with our fingers crossed. But is the language a little disconcerting?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we're starting to get better. I mean, there was structurally deficient. There's design flaws in some bridges that need to be fixed. There's terms like fracture critical, which is really when you've got to pay attention because these things are really in imminent danger. But look, I think that the more people are talking about this, the more people understand that these roads and these bridges and the infrastructure that you're using is potentially hazardous, then that really does make people pay attention. And this is a theme I think that's emerging here in this show, is that it may take these kinds of tragedies. We don't want these. Obviously, it's horrible when it happens, but we shouldn't waste this opportunity to amplify the discussion and then to use it to put infrastructure on the front burner of the policy discussion.
Should there be some kind of a national infrastructure bank to be able to pay for some of this stuff?
I think we think about it, the bank as some kind of source of funding that would come out to cities and states and whoever else. But I think that the way that an infrastructure bank could work is to really leverage existing loan programs and other things. So it's literally loaning money out like a bank would loan out, not just as a general purpose kind of grant program like we do now. But then to the point we mentioned earlier, always prioritizing infrastructure investments that meet some other kind of national objective. So the president had an initiative to double exports in 5 years. It's exactly the right kind of economic goal that he should be talking about and that we should deliver as a country to take advantage of rising global demand, all this stuff. That should then lead you then to a set of infrastructure investments because we need to do things like expand ports. We need to work on the freight system. We need to work on the rail system in and around Chicago. I mean, there's all these things that are derivative of a national economic goal, and that's what an infrastructure bank could start to deliver.
Should we also think of this in terms of not just jobs, but jobs with hopefully a good paycheck, with people with very specific kinds of skills? I mean, it's more than just shovel-ready stuff. You have to have some complicated skills if you're dealing with the electrical grid, for instance. But should we think of this as a way of developing more better jobs?
Absolutely. I think that when we start to think about infrastructure jobs has always meant shovel-ready. Give someone a shovel, right, have a fill in a pothole, and that's a short-term construction job. But we added all these up, and we found that infrastructure jobs are actually 11% of the national workforce, directly related to infrastructure, not, you know, cutting the hair of the guy who's filling in the pothole, but infrastructure jobs directly. It's 11%. Huh. And they pay really well at the low end of the scale, maybe not the higher end of the scale, but they have low barriers to entry. They pay well. They're very difficult to outsource to other countries. And so if we're trying to put Americans back to work, if we're trying to boost low-income workers and reduce inequality, infrastructure jobs are a great way to start to do that.
When you say sort of the low end of the upper scale, what kinds of – typically what's an hourly wage for a good infrastructure job?
Look, infrastructure jobs are huge. They're everything from folks driving buses. They're driving trucks in particular. There's a lot of jobs in trade and logistics in particular. And we just had some job numbers that came out just a few weeks ago, and we found that infrastructure jobs are actually passing and growing faster than overall jobs throughout the economy. So, and they're not just construction jobs too. I think people think that these are just, you know, they're building, that matters. But 70%, more than 70% of these infrastructure jobs are actually in operations, and so it's the people actually making the system work long term. It's not just the short-term stuff.
Let's talk a bit about water. And from, you know, out in California, of course, there's the droughts, there are the floods in the Oklahoma, the sort of central part of the states. There's sea level rise in places like Florida, parts of New Jersey still recovering from Sandy that did so much to destroy or certainly hurt the infrastructure there. What should we do about water? Nothing more basic than that.
Right. And I think this is becoming a much greater issue, not just because of the things you mentioned, Sandy and the drought. But the drought, I think, in particular, is of major importance. More than a quarter of the nation's counties had some kind of drought conditions in 2014. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, this is a lot of the places where the country is growing. I mean, the Intermountain West, parts of the West Coast there in California, this is where, and we're a growing nation, and this is where the growth is happening in these areas that are starting to experience these problems. So we have two different things going on. We have lack of water in those areas, and then probably too much water in some areas in the Northeast, in the Midwest, and obviously particularly in Houston and what Texas is dealing with right now. So we've got to think about this in more urgent terms, I think, because water, as you said, is fundamental, is so basic. It's so intrinsic. We think about infrastructure as an economic priority, but water is almost is so much more basic than that. But same kind of thing. It's going to cost a lot of money just to update and upgrade the systems that are in place right now. Folks have probably seen pictures of workers digging up literally wooden pipes, in roads all across the Northeast and the Midwest. You've got a lot of leakage that's happening in some of these investments. So water is so challenging because it's literally hidden, right? In so many ways, it's underground, and we only notice it when you turn on the faucet and the tap is not working.
Well, we're almost up on a break here. Just a quick shout-out to the Water Department here in Philadelphia, because I know that they have done a lot of things to try to capture, I guess, even recycle water and to use it much more effectively.
And it's a great example of where we think about infrastructure as a solution, and in some cases, places like the Water Department there in Philadelphia, not building new infrastructure, not building giant pipes or whatever it is to channel water through an area just to kind of get it out of these cities. They're actually capturing it, and it's called green infrastructure, and starting to let the permeable surfaces absorb water. And then, by the way, you get to deliver parks and green and open space as a result of all that. It's really a win-win, and Philadelphia is definitely a pioneer in this area.
And that's Robert Puentes, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about investing in infrastructure, the nation's bridges and roads and water pipes. He's senior fellow with the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program. Join our conversation. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the nation's infrastructure, and by that I mean it's roads and bridges, tunnels, railroad tracks, pipelines. Our guest is Robert Puentes. He's a senior fellow with the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program, where he directs the program's Metropolitan Infrastructure Initiative. We've been talking about the train derailment here in Philadelphia 2 weeks ago, also talking about the water systems across the country, the need for repairing the roads and addressing a whole bunch of infrastructure needs. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Robert, just picking up, it's just to be a little bit more specific, I know things that are happening in Philadelphia, for instance, roof gardens. I mean, it doesn't seem like a high-tech solution, but roof gardens is one way to manage water.
Absolutely. It's not just happening in Philadelphia. I mean, New York is starting to do this. They're going to invest like $2.5 billion over the next 20 years or so in all of this kind of, again, it's called green infrastructure. So it's using the natural environment to do the things that we would usually engineer for something else to happen. So rooftop vegetation is one thing. Porous pavements is another thing. Soils, all is designed to make these cities more permeable, so water can be absorbed into the natural environment, again, as opposed to being channeled away, where you're not really getting rid of the problem, you're just moving it somewhere else. And so, again, I think this is some of the tragedy that we're starting to see in places like Texas, which, again, is not a normal situation, but
sure,
because of the floods that have happened there, maybe this is going to help us think through, well, how can you engineer a city and use better green infrastructure, more the natural environment, to deal with some of these challenges that are only going to come from more of these treacherous rains.
But what I hear you saying is sometimes the solution isn't the high-tech one. It's the one that sort of works with nature.
Yeah, sometimes the best infrastructure solution doesn't have anything to do with infrastructure.
Exactly. We have an email from Elena, and I think she probably speaks for a lot of people. She says it's a matter of national priorities. The U.S. found more than $1 trillion to fight an unnecessary war in Iraq, but then says we can't afford to fix the infrastructure. We're on our way to becoming a third world country. I mean, I think there is some worry especially when you go to other countries and you kind of see how they do their infrastructure, I think there is a worry that, we're falling behind and can't catch up.
Yeah, and places like China get a lot of attention for, doing this, and they've built so many miles of high-speed rail, for example. And you've got gleaming airports, and when folks leave the Pudong airport and you wind up back at JFK in New York, and you wonder which is the emerging economy and which one is, more mature. But, you know, China does things that we can't do in this country and probably don't want to do in this country. And so I think that the solutions are going to come not just from a central government directing things and directing the economy and directing these investments. I don't think anybody wants to in America wants to live like that. But it's really then about this bottoms up different kind of problem solving. And we overemphasize, I think, the federal role, because the federal government does provide money for transportation and public transit and things like that. But so many other things that are actually working quite well, the telecommunications network, the freight rail network, all of these things are privately owned and operated. They've got, you know, a public regulatory element to them, but these are really these have nothing to do with public money at all in a lot of cases. So again, it's this mismatch of public, private, and nonprofit money that's going to get some things done in the near future.
Do you think there's too much regulation? I mean, that whoever's doing a project has to jump through too many hoops?
Yeah, and there's it's not just lack of regulation. I think it's lack of then collaboration and just and working together, particularly across agencies, particularly here on the federal level, where you've got so many different agencies involved in some projects, and whether it's transport and energy and the EPA, and then you've got the Corps of Engineers, and you've got the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. All of these things have to be coordinated better, and that's something the administration tried to do a few years ago, and identify some priority projects and say, here are the things we're going to get done. And it takes that constant connection between these different regulatory bodies, because they've got so much other things to do. If they're not focused on getting these things done, it's just going to take years and years and years. We've seen that time and time again.
Let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. George from Lewis, Delaware is joining us on Radio Times. George, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi there.
I wondered what your guests thought about I live in Delaware, which is 27 cents per gallon for gas tax, but certain states like Illinois, it's a percentage of the price of the gas. And so when gas is $4 a gallon, Illinois is killing it. And when Delaware is $2 a gallon, the state's getting shafted, I think. So I think that would be a good way for politicians to raise more money without it looking like they're raising taxes.
Oh, interesting. Well, George, let me see what Robert Puente says.
I think it makes perfect sense. I think the caller is exactly right. I wish it was that easy. I wish it was about convincing them that there's easy ways to do this. That we almost see the opposite, though, happening. There are some states that have their gasoline taxes indexed to inflation. So it just, you know, it naturally just would have to go up every year or every couple of years, whatever it is. And what we see, unfortunately, is in some states actually them taking off that indexing. And so actually giving people a tax cut because it's I guess it's more politically popular to do it that way. So I think the caller's exactly right. There's 50 states. There's 50 different gasoline taxes. They can all be raised or not raised in different ways. But we've got to get past this notion that these taxes are just going – are wasting money. And a lot of this comes down to trust, and this comes up in the Amtrak conversation. In many transit agencies it comes up. People just don't believe in some cases that the money is going to be spent better. People are willing to invest, and we see these things happening at the ballot box every year where 70-80% of these measures for infrastructure pass, because people, if they know what they're getting, are willing to vote for it. It's when it's more of this amorphous kind of black box, you know, mentality. Well, the gasoline tax is going to be raised. It's going to go here, and then it'll all work out. The American people are very attuned to that, and it's a tough sell.
Well, it seems to me if that money then is invested in filling potholes, I think anyone driving around, especially this part of the country where it seems like potholes appear almost magically after the winter is over.
Yeah, right.
I mean, if you see a road that had potholes and now it doesn't, I mean, that's your tax dollars at work, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, we've got to do a better job at articulating that. And we've got to lay out then a new kind of a vision and a real articulation of where the money is going. And we've got to be clear about that. And it's not going to do everything. And I think the expectations are when the politicians spend the political capital to get these taxes raised, there's an over expectation that it's going to solve all of these problems. And And they don't. They go to direct. They go to certain things. And I think we've got to be clear about that, because again, the American people are they're going to understand this stuff,
sure,
if it's explained to them in a clear and transparent way.
Because it seems interact. I use that with quotations. Interact with infrastructure every day. I mean, it's so much a part of our life. You turn on the water,
absolutely,
there it is.
Yeah.
Let me see what an email from Sam says. If Washington cannot get their act together, can private industries investing in infrastructure be sustainable over a long period of time? I guess asking whether private companies can do what the government can't or won't.
In some cases, I don't want to overemphasize the role. It's not a silver bullet. They're not going to come in and solve all of these challenges. They're only going to invest in projects that are going to generate a return for them. There's some kind of business case to be made. And that's, it's America. It's perfectly fine. But it's not going to be all kinds of projects. There are ways that we can incorporate the private sector resources. There's a lot of private sector innovation, I think, that we're starting to see. There's a really interesting project here in Northern Virginia outside of Washington where they put in these high occupancy toll lanes. So it's the toll lanes folks are familiar with, but they're dynamically tolled. And so when the congestion is low, the rate is low. When congestion is high, the rates are higher.
Yeah.
And so they're doing these innovative things and then taking on that risk. And that's the important part here, is that it's not the government or the public sector investing these things. And if it doesn't work, then the taxpayers are holding the bag. In this case, the private sector is saying, look, we want to make money off this, but we're also willing to take the risk. And if it doesn't work, and again, if driving is low and the people aren't paying the tolls, then it's the private sector who's absorbing the risk in that.
We have an email from Charles. He says, I think the people who are advocates for infrastructure improvements need to change their rhetoric from the billions of dollars that are needed to the small impact that a tax increase would have on an individual. Make the case that any driver can afford $2 a month. The impact is worth billions of dollars. I mean, it's a more sort of a linguistic change, and billions, even today, feels like a lot of money, although I think trillions is probably really what we're talking about. But he's saying, take it down to the level that an individual can understand it and feel that they can afford it.
Absolutely. We have to do a much better job at that. It's so much about – we talk about it as the economy and these big global issues, and the Society of Civil Engineers talks about the trillions of dollars that we need to invest. And those numbers are so big and so vast, it's hard for folks to understand. But this has to be brought down. All the things that you mentioned, it has to be – people deal with infrastructure literally every single day. And they're very supportive of it. We're not just the only two nerds on infrastructure on this. You and me, Martha.
I'm glad to know that.
People get this and they understand the value of it. And if it's explained and if it's clear to them how it's going to affect their daily commute, or it's how it's going to affect their jobs, or it's going to affect their natural environment or their kids or anything, they're willing to pony up for that.
We haven't really talked about the energy infrastructure, and certainly that's changing to some degree, certainly here in Pennsylvania with the natural gas and the Marcellus Shale and pipelines, and there's some controversy about that. But when we talk about infrastructure, one wonders sort of how far afield we can go, but I'm assuming energy infrastructure plays a really important role.
Oh, without a doubt. And again, for all the reasons you mentioned, it's changing rapidly. It's really shifted. It also is a global issue. It changes some of these global economies. But it's not just the government doing this. You've got private investment that's taking advantage of this because they're making a lot of money in this. But you've got to transport it. And so you've got the private freight rail that's moving things. And then it goes to the refineries in and around Philly and other places. And so the challenge with infrastructure is that it is these different sectors. It's transport, it's energy, it's water, it's telecommunications, it's the green infrastructure we talked about. And even though these things all work as a system together, they're all designed, governed, and financed and delivered so differently that when you're trying to make it clear and rational to the general public, it's so complicated and it's very complex. So that's part of the issue that we have. It is about messaging. Right. It is about narrative. But again, I think people are receptive if you explain it to them.
When the hot summer weather comes and there, sometimes there are blackouts and power loss, and certainly energy companies are watching very carefully, especially on those very hot days when people are using their air conditioner. Is the electrical grid in shape to handle the demand, the need?
It is. I think in many cases, it gets back a little bit to this issue of these pinch points again, and it's not, it's a big — it's a big system that covers big areas and big regions of the country, but things can go down in certain areas, as we saw from the blackout several years ago. These things are often very localized and very kind of pointillistic. So, but it's also an area, again, which where you have we have energy utilities, but you've got the private sector. It's kind of this quasi-public-private thing. There is innovation that's happening in these sectors. The outfit of sensors and electronics to manage the load and to shift things around is very encouraging, I think. We can apply those same kind of innovations throughout the rest of the system. We'd be in good shape.
We have an email from Craig. He says, could the technology being developed for automating driving cars be applied to trains more cheaply than positive train control? Do you have an answer to that?
I don't know. I think that it's a good example. It's an illustration of where, again, not to belabor this, but where you have private enterprise that are starting to develop these kinds of technological fixes that are kind of absent in a lot of ways from some of the public-driven infrastructure like on the railway system. So a better connection at that, I'm sure we have some things to learn from what's going on with cars.
You're joining us from Washington, D.C., and Congress is going to be voting on a number of these issues that we have been talking about. I mean, do you have any confidence that they can address some of these really important issues? That pause tells
the
us.
The pregnant quite, pause probably
tells us quite a bit, but I appreciate a thoughtful answer.
Washington is not leading right now on this. What we're seeing is the action is coming out of cities and states and metropolitan areas across the country, and eventually Washington will react. Washington will reflect what's going on around the country, and when cities and states and they say that, well, here's what we need Washington to do, Washington will be accommodating to that. But if we're looking to them to lead and to kind of sit on top of this pyramid and rain money down on cities and states, it's just not going to happen until we see any evidence to the contrary. And so they're trying to do what they can with what they have. And the administration is putting together innovative loan programs and trying to stretch these dollars and trying to help provide capacity for local governments and for states to take advantage of new things. And so it's kind of a lot of behind the scenes kind of stuff. But, anything like the Eisenhower era, the interstate era, or even the stimulus package. I mean, these were moonshots that I don't see happening anytime soon. Again, later when things happen and this town gets its act together, they'll react, but not leading anytime soon.
About a minute before I have to say goodbye, what worries you the most when it comes to our infrastructure?
Part of it is the lack of understanding. Again, if we're still, not to belabor the point, but if we're waiting for Washington to come to the rescue, it's not going to happen. So we're starting to see that shift happening, and we're starting to recognize that there are things that can go on across this country that have nothing to do with Washington. Once we start to recognize that, I think we'll see a lot more innovation.
Well, Robert Puentes, I always enjoy talking about infrastructure with you. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
I always do, too. One nerd to another. Thank you so much for having me.
You got it. Robert Puentes is a senior fellow with the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program, and he directs the program's Metropolitan Infrastructure Initiative. And we were spending the hour talking about the train derailment in Philadelphia 2 weeks ago and all the various infrastructure needs that we have across the country. And if you're an infrastructure nerd, like Robert and myself, send us an email. Tell us what you think about the show. You can also check us out on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.